Trend number four, helping everyone join America's jobs revolution. As documented in prior trends issues, the research is unambiguous. A regular job does a lot more for individuals and society than enable a useful economic transaction. It gives the worker something worthwhile to do on a regular basis. In the process, it minimizes the time available for engaging in crime and addictions. In American culture, who you are is determined by what you do. Whether you're a carpenter, plumber, technician, manager, or attorney. That's why having a job gives you a sense of belonging and identity. It also builds skills, confidence, and social bonds. Beyond that, it provides the worker the sense of pride that comes from economic self-sufficiency and the knowledge that he or she is earning something rather than being given things. Furthermore, in the case of younger males, it dramatically increases their ability to have a successful marriage and be a part of a traditional nuclear family. In short, a case can be made that a fully employed populace is an indispensable factor contributing to gross national happiness and social stability, as well as to economic growth. Therefore, full employment has been an American national priority for at least the past 100 years, and every presidential campaign inevitably promises to deliver more and better jobs. However, over the past 120 years, the bottom line result was that a significant share of the American people was not able to have productive jobs in our economy. That led to the creation of a permanent dependent class, which relies upon the government for their survival. To address this problem, a set of institutions we now call the social safety net was developed in three major waves known as the Progressive Era, the New Deal, and the Great Society. This has created a modern American population consisting of six categories. 1. Students, most of whom are 24 years of age or younger. 2. Unpaid caregivers, such as parents, not employed outside the home. 3. Those who are participating in the labor force, which includes those employed full or part-time, as well as those looking for work in the public or private sectors. 4. Those classified as disabled. 5. The retired, most of whom are over 55. And 6. Others, including those in prison. The disabled, unemployed, retired, and imprisoned are all supported, at least in part, by the social safety net. The stagnation in employment from 2000 to 2016 is exactly what we expect to see during the transition phase between the installation and deployment phases of every techno-economic revolution. During the transition phase of the mass production revolution in the 1930s and 1940s, labor force participation remained high because the social safety net was weak. The excess was reflected in skyrocketing unemployment. To compensate, the government created jobs through programs like the Works Progress Administration and later the public-private war economy. Similarly, the transitional phase of the information revolution brought its own employment crisis in the years 2000 to 2016. However, rather than jobs programs, the government used the dramatically expanded safety net programs, including Social Security Disability. The difference is that make-work job programs are easily scaled back, permitting the subsidized and enhanced human capital to be redeployed. So today, as the golden age of the fifth techno-economic revolution accelerates, many healthy, working-age American adults are not working but receiving significant government-funded help. The impact of this idle adult population shows up in the labor force participation stats. Even though our country is 10 years into an economic recovery, with U3 unemployment at 3.5%, we are still well below the pre-recession proportion of working-age Americans in the workforce. Behind this low labor force participation rate stands the extraordinary rise in those on Social Security disability. In July 2015, Dr. Vincent J. Malonga and Dr. Lance Brofman published a report titled Disability's Destabilizing Impact on the Labor Market. They noted that labor force participation had historically behaved cyclically within a gently declining trend. Participation consistently tended to fall during recessions and rise during economic recoveries as job prospects improved. But in the most recent business cycle from 2000 through 2015, the labor force participation rate fell as expected during the recession phase, but kept falling during the recovery as well. Since then, there has been an improvement in labor force participation, as well as the bellwether participation rates for males in the prime working age category of 25 to 54. Nonetheless, the participation rate for prime aged men is still far below the rates of the 1990s. Notably, the outsized rise in disability payments in the Great Recession essentially bankrupted the system and forced a congressional bailout in 2015. In a March 2018 report titled Disability and Participation, Malonga and Brofman explained that as part of the 2015 bailout legislation, various reforms were enacted, such as requiring medical evidence for disability claims. Another reform excluded individuals and entities convicted of felonies related to the Social Security Act or who had been previously penalized for submission of false evidence from acting as sources of medical evidence. As the latest data indicates, these reforms were responsible for the decline in disability rolls that began to occur in 2016. Indeed, even though the total population has increased, the numbers applying for and receiving disability payments has declined since 2015. Most Social Security disability claims are processed through a network of local Social Security Administration, field offices, and state agencies. Today, we can see that applications at both the field offices and state agencies have finally declined to below pre-recession levels. The same is true of the numbers receiving benefit awards. And while there is considerable volatility in the monthly data, a 12-month moving average of data clearly shows a downward trend. The actual number of Americans receiving disability payments is about 8.4 million and began declining from about 9 million in 2016. Coincidentally or not, labor force participation has been improving in jagged fashion since 2016, and the news is likely to get better. While some of the reforms introduced by the 2015 bailout legislation were immediately enacted, some are being phased in, and others will not take effect until 2022. Building on the changes already in the pipeline, the Trump administration proposed a series of new regulations relating to the administration of the Social Security Disability Program in November of 2019. These rules would have the effect of reducing the number of people collecting disability payments by conducting more frequent reviews of whether a person's medical condition improves sufficiently to allow substantial gainful activity. The rules would create a new category of recipient called Medical Improvement Likely, where reviews would occur biannually. Abuse of the disability system is not the only cause of the downward trend in labor participation that has been in effect since the 1990s. No doubt the opioid crisis and other varieties of increased substance abuse has had an adverse effect on society generally, as well as workforce participation. Other factors are undoubtedly at work as well, but at least there are specific efforts being made to curb flagrant abuse of the disability system. Given this trend, we offer the following forecasts. First, the existing and proposed changes to the disability system will have a major impact on the workforce. Indeed, with the overall unemployment rate hovering around post-World War II lows of 3.5%, labor markets are tight, yet inflationary wage increases remain notably absent. Currently, the participation rate for prime-age males is at 89.2%, versus the absolute 2014 low of 87.9%. Maintaining this upward trajectory would go a long way to reinforcing the economy's growth record. Given normal labor force growth of about 1% per year, if the participation rate for prime-age males were merely to get back to the roughly 91% level that prevailed before the Great Recession, new workers would be generated at a rate of about 1.2 million yearly. This would provide further support for consumer spending, overall economic growth, and social stability. Second, putting the genuinely disabled onto a path to participate more fully in the economy will be worth the effort. The big payback from disability reform comes from putting to work those who are not legitimately disabled. However, there is a lot to be said for finding ways to gainfully employ disabled people who deserve more from life than playing video games and watching TV. A combination of employer incentives and adaptive technology could enable people with physical and cognitive impairments to create value. This is not only good for the employee, but for the employer and the broader community. And third, reforming college loan programs will also help produce more and better prepared workers in the medium term. Over the past two decades, the surplus worker population has been shunted into academic holding cells because the economy was not able to absorb them. Changes in the college loan criteria made it possible for almost anyone to borrow money for almost any field of study, regardless of their prospects for repaying the loan. In all too many cases, this not only took the person out of the labor pool for 4 to 6 years, it also eliminated the opportunity that the person would have to get on-the-job training during those years. Because of the poor outcomes, reform is almost certain. The likely result is that fewer students will attend full-time liberal arts bachelor's programs and more will pursue part-time vocational programs. Coupled with skills-based immigration policies and reform of the disability system, this will go a long way toward eliminating our growing skills shortage.